This week on Writers, Inc.
And as to sort of the characters, they're there from the start. I mean, you know I know Alex Rider very well. I grew up with Bond. I ditto Sherlock Holmes. So these are characters who are very close to me. And I don't have to sit down and puzzle about them. I think that a character speaks to you. I think that's the only best way I can put it. I don't create the character. The character tells me about himself or herself. And if that sounds pretentious, because I don't like writers who say, oh, my characters are out of control, I never know what they're going to do. That's not true. I know everything my characters are going to do, but only because I know them so well.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and indie powerhouses Jay Thorne and Zach Bohannon as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers Inc.
JD, I hear you got another, you got a horror screenplay in the works.
Dude, okay.
It's on Daffy Duck.
Six words for you. I never thought that this would happen. Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. a legit horror movie based on Winnie the Pooh. Now I sent you the trailer because like somebody sent this to me and I thought that they were messing with me. I thought it was like an early April Fool's joke or something, but it's for real. So anybody listening, go out there, go on YouTube, Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. The reason I wanted to bring this up though, and how this happened is Winnie the Pooh, the books, they're coming out of copyright. They're going into public domain or they already have. And these guys just jumped all over it. They literally filmed a horror movie based on Winnie the Pooh, Christopher Robbins and the entire cast. They filmed it within 10 days from what I was reading in the UK somewhere. They had to steer clear of certain things. You know, Disney has a particular image for Winnie the Pooh, so they couldn't use like the red vest and, you know, that particular look. But, you know, if you ever go back and read the original books, they're very different than what Disney did. But there's a lot of stuff like this that's coming out of copyright, you know, over the next, you know, 10, 20 years or so. And, you know, this just being one of them. It just shows like, you know, as an author, what you need to do to really try and protect your stuff, because most of us tend to default back to, you know, that you fall in the normal copyright law. I think it's what, 50 years after you die or 150 years after you die. I forget. I know if it's you're using a pen name, it's 75 years after the publication. And it's different in certain countries. But there's ways around that. And a lot of authors don't realize that. The easiest way, and you obviously need to talk to a professional on this, but a lot of authors now are creating trusts and they're filing their copyright under the trust. So as long as the trust itself is in existence, it doesn't actually matter if the author passes away or not. And this is why it's important. You know, something like Winnie the Pooh generates a ton of money. Tom Clancy, they're running through the same problem right now with Jack Ryan. You know, like there were certain clauses in some of the film contracts that allow those film studios to continue the Jack Ryan story, even though Tom Clancy's no longer around to sign off on it. And his family, you know, who technically own the rights, have no real say in what happens. It's one or two sentences in that contract. So these kind of things slip through. But Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. I'll be taking my daughter to see that one for sure.
I saw the trailer for that weeks ago. We were kind of talking before, and I know what you guys were talking about. Now I get it. But when I saw that trailer weeks ago, I did not think it would turn into JD giving legal advice on Writers Inc. So it's kind of crazy how things turn out sometimes.
Well, you know, related to that, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to watch it or not, but the new Lord of the Rings is getting ready to hit Amazon Prime, or maybe it's already up. I don't know. I haven't checked.
I don't think it's up yet.
It's coming really soon, and it's supposedly like the most expensive TV show ever made. And there was this whole bidding war with the Tolkien estate, and so talking about like, you know, rights after you're dead, like you never know, and like this thing could generate, you know, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. There's a lot of money at stake, and the one thing I heard that made me chuckle a little bit was someone said, if this isn't a big hit, the price of laundry detergent's going up. Because Bezos, you know, we get everything from Amazon, so this thing better be a hit.
yeah, I wanted to bring it up because a lot of these things tend to slip through. And, you know, like this with the Tom Clancy thing in particular, you know, it's one or two sentences. And if you go on Google, you can actually find it because there's websites that are dedicated to following this. But it was basically something that was just in that one of his film or TV contracts. I'm kind of running into it on a smaller scale right now because the 4MK series is with a studio and that's something that's underway. I wanted to use one of the detectives that's in the 4MK series, a guy named Frank Poole. He's an FBI agent. I wanted to do a quick cameo, you know, and have the guy just appear in the book that I'm working on now. And it's literally, you know, half a chapter or something. Like, he's just kind of in and out. But I just figured for readers, it would be fun to see that. So I ran it by my agent. She quickly looped in the film attorney that I work with. And he said, nope, you can't do that. If you do, then it's considered an author sequel to something, something, something. And because of this clause, then the studio has first rights to it. And, you know, like all this stuff. And, you know, like I never thought of it. But, you know, that's in my contract. It's signed. So there's nothing I can do. So I had to go and change that character name. But, you know, a lot of hands, you know, in certain buckets, you know, even for somebody like it's not even produced yet. But, you know, you still have to deal with it.
Wow.
Wow. Those are small things you just don't think about, I guess, until you're in those positions or, you know, get that advice from somebody. So, yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. That's interesting.
So speaking of advice, I went out to my editor and asked her a question. Let me see if you guys know the answer to this. Do you use double punctuation at all in any, like, your writing? So like a question, like a question mark with an exclamation mark, you know, like using two different forms of punctuation.
I don't think I've ever done that.
No, the only time I would ever do that would be if it was like a character sending a text message or something like that. I might do something like that. But otherwise, like just in regular text, no, I don't do that.
Yeah, so I had a character in the story I'm working on now where they yell a question, you know, so I wanted to make sure I got it across that they were actually yelling it without having to put some kind of weird, you know, tag at the end. But I wasn't sure what would come first if you used two punctuation marks, the question mark or the exclamation mark, or to end the sentence with the exclamation mark and then the question mark. And apparently there's a rule for this. So you basically, the first piece of punctuation falls in line with whatever the sentence is, and then the exclamation mark goes on the end to basically emphasize the question itself. So I don't know. I got schooled today because I honestly thought it was the other way around.
That's interesting. I never, ever thought about that.
JD is just a fountain of education today. He just, I mean, he's just bringing it all. He's bringing his A game.
Well, that's all I've got. So
honestly, if I came across that in a book, I'd put that book down. I'd be like, that just, it looks too awkward. They should have used a dialogue tag.
Well, you know, there's different ways to do that sort of thing. You know, like a lot of authors will just put like that sentence in caps. You know, the whole thing with the question mark at the end. You know, there's different ways.
Stupid too.
Yeah. Well, how would you do it, Zach? You've got a character yelling a question. How would you do it?
I would use a dialogue tag in that instance. I would do a question mark, and then I would say like, "She yelled" or "She shouted" or something like that. Like that's what I would personally do.
Okay.
But you know, that's just you'd put my book down in there. He should have used double punctuation or put it in bold.
What's this dialogue tag doing here? I'm not reading.
What's
this
idiot doing?
Amateurish dialogue tags. Who uses those? So I actually, when I go back through on my final pass, I try to take out almost every dialogue tag. Like I've got no problem putting them in on a first draft
thing too.
Yeah, well, it's a many author thing. And I actually, there's a book, I think I talked about this before. It's called The Narrator. And it's basically Misery, but with narrators. So somebody kidnaps a narrator and forces him to narrate an audiobook. And the book itself is narrated by Scott Brick, you know, who's obviously one of the best out there. And one of the things that they touch on in there is, as you know, he's reading, and I'm pretty sure this is Scott Brick, you know, feeding the author this information because they're friends. He actually, when he narrates, he cuts out the dialogue tags. You know, which is something I never really thought of before. But if you listen to an audiobook, it's pretty rare that you actually hear somebody, you know, he said, she said, you know, a lot of those dialogue tags tend to disappear. So that's really the narrator taking them out. You know, so I try to do that with my own writing. I try to either, you know, see if I can just, the sentence can exist without it, you know, just draw a line through it and see if it still works. And a lot of times it does, as long as you can tell who's saying it. And if it doesn't, if you, you know, you've got multiple people in the room and you need to point out that it's a particular character, just try to replace that with some, you know, form of action or something, you know, a little bit more definitive than just a little dialogue tag.
Just to be clear, I'm very scarce with dialogue tags in my writing. But like you said, I think if you had to use double punctuation, that would be an instance where I would use one. Personally, that's just me.
Not
but
to call you out,
but I'm very scarce with it too. That makes sense.
I've got a copy of Deep South right here, where I took a highlighter and just.
I don't know what Deep South is. I wrote a book called Dead South. Dead South. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll leave you alone.
you just dissed me without knowing it.
I tried.
It's okay. Also, I think I'm figuring out really quick what your book of the year is, and I'm going to tell all the audiences. I'm going to tell the audience that every time JD mentions the narrator, they need to take a shot, because I think this is like the third episode in a row you've mentioned that book.
it was good. You know, you should definitely check it out. I don't know if it's even out yet, but I'm a big fan of anything that Scott Brick does.
Oh, he's amazing. Yeah. He's an amazing narrator. So take a shot.
So, Zach, what are you working on these days?
Nothing.
All right,
I'm
JD,
working on the next
Deep
South book. I'm working on Deep South now. No, that's pretty much it. I have really no big news update. I did. I'll give a little shout out here because she listens every single week, and because I don't get to hang out with authors that much these days. But I got to see Honoré Quarter twice last week, which was awesome. I love Honoré, so I got to see her twice last week, which was really cool. So, and like I said, she listens every week, so big shout out to her.
Nice.
But other than that, yeah, I'm working on Deep South. And now I'm just going to call it that. I'm going to go get all the covers changed and everything.
Yeah, I honestly think you should. It's a better name.
Dead South, it's a zombie book. It's actually a way better name. So keywords, baby. But anyways, no, that's pretty much it. So what about you guys, JD?
I'm just writing one-liners trying to make fun of you. That's I spent my entire week just trying to come up with stuff to ad lib on the show.
Watching trailers for crappy Winnie the Pooh movies in your theater.
Yeah, pretty much. I actually circled back and I started watching Mr. Mercedes because I haven't seen that yet, and I'm pretty much run out of stuff to watch on Netflix and everything. So I think I'm about four episodes into that, and it's pretty good. My wife and I are finally wrapping up Ozark. We've got like 10 minutes left in the final episode, which is a phenomenal show. I'm going to really miss that one.
You stopped with 10 minutes left?
She's got an alarm. So she gets up at 5 every morning to write and exercise and stuff like that. So like she cuts out of the theater at the exact same time every night, regardless of where we are in a show. That's why we're still watching Ozark when it's been done for, however number of months at this point.
As soon as that alarm goes off, do you have like people in the little vest and hats come out and start sweeping?
Turn the lights off.
Turn the lights on. Turn the overhead lights on.
I may have to try that.
It's gonna be your daughter soon. She's gonna have to wear that costume.
She's too busy going to school. So she's loving the kindergarten thing.
Like, I was gonna say, how's that going?
Yeah, she doesn't even want to come home. They have a recess that like class ends technically at 2:45, and then they go out and have recess, and then you can kind of pick them up, and we just walk over there and get her. I think my wife got home at almost 6 o'clock the first day. Like, she didn't want to leave the playground. Yesterday was like 5 something, and yesterday she came home with like two of her friends from kindergarten, and she's like, "Mama, we're having a sleepover." Like, we didn't even know where their parents were, because we're right there by the school. So like they just walked over here. So my wife had to track down the parents that had these kids picked up. And then we had to explain to our 4-year-old, well, you can't have a sleepover. You're 4, and you can't have a sleepover because it's a school night. And all of that turned into a lot of tears from all 3 4-year-olds. And yeah, that was fun. But she's loving school. And I'm thrilled about that.
And meanwhile, the parents are like, "Where are our kids at?" "Oh, I think they went to the crime author's house over there."
Yeah.
I think that's where they're at.
the scary guy with the cemetery in the backyard.
They're in the theater watching Hellraiser.
Oh, man. We better start this show.
I have to start bringing popcorn, man. You guys are pretty entertaining. I just sit back and let you go at each other. I'm good, man. I'm good. I'm doing well. Been working on a few things, not publicly talking about, but making some progress. And the kids are back in school and back in the routine. And my wife had an event, so she's not in the place today, which is kind of nice. And she never listens to the show, so I don't have to worry about saying that.
I was gonna say there. like an event, like she's going to an event. She had a cardiac event. Like, what does that even mean?
She's in sort of like event planning coordination now, and she had to go because otherwise she's remote like 90% of the time. So I'm kind of like JD was a few weeks ago, where I'm like, oh my gosh, I have this whole place to myself for like an hour and a half. So yeah, I'm kind of enjoying that.
It's odd, dude, being back in the regular routine is like, when you have kids and stuff, it makes such a huge difference.
It does.
I was actually talking to our buddy T.W. Piperbrook. We were sending some video messages back and forth earlier, and his kid just went back to school today. I guess up in the Northeast, you guys go to school like way later than we do down here, because like my daughter's been in school since August 8th or something like that. He was out on a plot walk, his first one in months, and he was so excited to like just be back in his regular routine. So it's awesome when you can. When we have our routines back.
No doubt. I will totally agree with that. Well, what do you say we take care of some business and then we'll get to our guests for the week? I want to give a nice shout out to our wonderful sponsors over there at Kobo Writing Life, who empower you, the author, to take your self-publishing career into your own hands. You know, with Kobo, you set your price, you keep all your rights, and there's never any exclusivity agreement. So if you're interested, use the link in the show notes or head on over to KoboWritingLife.com. JD, who's up this week?
All right, this one's going to be fun. We've got Anthony Horowitz. He's here to talk about his latest thriller. It's called With a Mind to Kill, which is set in the James Bond universe. So if you're curious to find out what it takes to write in a franchise like that, you definitely want to take notes on this one. Here he is, Anthony Horowitz.
Now, I understand that you received a human skull for your 13th birthday, but is it true that that was a gift from your mother?
It was actually, I think, Christmas rather than my birthday. I can't remember which of the two it was, but it is absolutely true. Yes, my mother had bought it for me. I don't know what is more peculiar, the fact that I asked for it or the fact that she went out and got it. But I still have it to this day. It's just upstairs, in fact.
No, I didn't realize that she got you something that you asked for. So this was on your list of things you wanted.
Yes, but you've got to understand, this has nothing to do with macabre sort of feelings about death or anything. I was very interested when I was a boy in the nature of who we are and where we are. And because I wanted to be a writer, I thought of myself as being inside this sort of peculiar capsule that was like, if you like, the spaceship, which the traveler, the brain, takes you to places in the world. And so I wanted to look inside. I wanted to see what it was like. And so that's why I wanted it. And I never did sort of silly things like, you know, putting sweet candies in it or you know, giving it a name or doing silly games with it. I was always very respectful of it. I'm very aware, as I say, I still have it. This was a human being. And nowadays, its use is as a memento mori. I mean, it reminds me to work hard, to keep writing, to do more words, to stop slacking because, you know, I'm getting on in life and quite soon I will look the same.
That's a very powerful token of memento mori when you think about it that way. Well, we're not here to talk about your childhood gift acceptance, you have just finished the third book in the James Bond series With a Mind to Kill. Tell us a little bit about this book.
Well, as you say, it is the third in a trilogy, and it is a trilogy because my first book, Trigger Mortis, began in the middle of Bond's career. It took place just immediately after his mission with Goldfinger. And then for my second book, Forever and a Day, I went back to the very beginning of his career, Bond getting his license to kill and starting out as 007. And so it seemed sensible to sort of finish it, to bookend it with an end of career novel. So now we're in 1963 and Bond is getting on a little bit. This follows on directly from The Man with the Golden Gun and even picks up on what Fleming wrote. And just to understand the book, you have to understand that, first of all, I'm talking about the books, not the movies. So I'm not talking here about Christopher Lee and that particular movie. I'm talking about the books as written by Fleming. And at the end of what is it called? Hold on a second. You Only Live Twice. Bond falls from a great height. He's hurt. He has amnesia. He takes up as a Japanese fisherman for a time. And then he tries to get home and wanders into Russia, where he is arrested by the KGB, who brainwash him and get him to kill M. And the next book, which is The Man with the Golden Gun, begins with this attempt by James Bond to kill, you know, the man he most admires in the world, M. And it goes wrong. But in my book, I imagine that they pretend that it has gone right. And he is then sent back to Russia to pretend to be brainwashed in order to discover a conspiracy that is going to change the balance of power in the entire world. So that is the book in a nutshell. You don't need to have read the original Ian Fleming books to enjoy it, of course, but that is where it sort of is situated in sort of the context. I have to just add, if I may, that I'm different to other modern Bond writers, continuation novel writers, because I've always set the books very much in the world of Ian Fleming, which is to say between 1953, 54 through to 1963. William Boyd, for example, set his book in a much more modern, and Jeffrey Deaver, it was present day.
Yeah, and I will say you've masterfully captured Fleming's voice, and I feel as though these novels really pay homage to that franchise. And I do think you were in a unique situation in that you didn't necessarily continue beyond the original work, the original canon. You're sort of in the middle of it. So what sort of challenges or advantages did you face in writing these books in the 50s and set in the 50s and 60s?
Well, the main challenge was getting it right. I mean, you've got to do two things when you're writing James Bond. You've not only got to work out what somebody might have been drinking, wearing, driving or whatever in 1963. That's easy enough. You can look on the net and just find out what cars were around, what drinks were around, what jackets and pants were around. But it's more than that, because what you've got to do is you've got to work out what would Fleming and therefore Bond have approved of. You know, what is the correct drink? What is the correct suit? What is the correct bottle of wine? You know, all the rest of it. So it's a question of getting not just the facts right, but the attitude right. But there is an enormous amount of research to do. And when I'm writing a Bond novel, I am endlessly stopping, which rather sort of annoys me. I like the flow of writing, but I have to stop just to check that every single thing fits with both the world as it was then and, of course, with the books. Because I'm very much in Fleming's world. So that, I guess, is the major challenge. There are other challenges too, which is, I suppose, actually an even bigger challenge than that, is rising to the occasion, because Ian Fleming is an absolutely superb writer. I think a lot of people think of Bond only through the movies, and the movies are great too, but the books, which are the sort of the world that I inhabit, are really, really well written. Nobody writes action better than Fleming. His ability to write out atmosphere is also fantastic. To get inside Ian Fleming, to get inside his characters, Bond's head, he does that extraordinarily well as well. So just upping my game, because I don't want these books to be by me. I want them to be the books that Fleming might have written if he was still writing now. So it's suppressing my own instincts and trying to do what he does, and that's a challenge. And then I guess you will always end up with the fact that the attitudes in the 1950s and 60s when Fleming was writing have changed a great deal. And there are modern sensitivities to consider, particularly with relation to women and to the role of women, to xenophobia, racism, and all that sort of stuff. I would defend Fleming. I don't find him an offensive writer in any way. But some of the characters and the tropes that he wrote about, which were very normal back then, now feel a little bit dated and possibly contentious. So that's another challenge. But, you know, talking about challenges just reminds me that when I write the books, they are a giant pleasure. I'm not sitting there going, oh, my God, what's going to happen next? I'm having a wonderful time. I love writing them.
The Guardian said that your Bond novels purr along with the sleek assurance of an Aston Martin, which I thought was a great way of complimenting you on pace. Are there specific things you do in the process to keep the story moving along at a good pace?
Well, I think that if you look at my work over the last 40 years, I mean, that's what I've always done. I mean, I'm interested in pace and a book being a page turner and keeping the audience gripped. You know, I'm a TV writer as well, and it's the same thing. A television audience is very, very easily bored, and it's all too easy to reach for the remote and turn the television off and go to bed. And so I'm always saying, don't do that. Look what I've got up here. I've got another murder. I've got another clue. I've got a development, something that'll surprise you. So to me, The act of writing is one of retention. It's holding the audience and keeping them going. And that's true of my Bond novels, but it's true of all the work I do, I think.
Are there any particular strategies that you employ, whether it's in the Bond work or your own work, to do that?
I'm not very good at sort of analyzing my own writing or anybody else's. I don't have any rules. I don't have a particular way of writing, and I haven't had any influences. I've never done a writing course. I think the single word answer I'd give you is immersion. When I write a Bond novel, I'm in that world. I am standing shoulder to shoulder with Bond. I am, you know, I'm seeing what he is seeing. I'm smelling what he's smelling. I taste that martini. I'm in the book, and I can write for 10, 12 hours at a trot and not even notice that the world is here because it's total immersion. And that, I guess, is the answer to your question. It's as simple as that. There are other things. You know, there, when you're doing a pastiche of somebody, you know, trying to emulate their writing style, you analyze what it is that makes their work a work. And so there are tricks that I play, types of language that I use, staccato sentences when the action is getting faster, that sort of extraordinary acidity. I don't know if you know that word, but it's in the Fleming novel, that sense of detachment. Sometimes, you know, sometimes you'll write with the character, seeing what he's seeing, but in a more melancholy moment, you're sort of, he's standing in the corner of the screen and you're just looking at the landscape and he's slightly lost. So there are sort of techniques and tricks in it. But as I say, the main thrust for me is one of just keeping the reader really hooked by being hooked myself.
Yes, yes. That makes perfect sense. In your sense of immersion, does that mean that particular project is the only thing you're working on at that moment?
Not necessarily, but it will be day to day. I tend not to do two projects in one day. At the moment, I'm writing three different things, which is sort of quite nightmarish, actually. I'm doing a TV series for Sony. I'm doing the next novel in my commitments to writing books. And I'm also plotting a novel, which I have to start next year. So that's three projects at once. But today, I've only done one of them. I try not to jump from one to the other because it's too, it interferes with my creative thoughts and process.
Yes, yes. There seems to be a spectrum of for authors of people who plot or plan a lot of the story versus people who just kind of show up and discover it along the way. Where would you fall on that spectrum?
I'm somewhere between the two. I like to keep myself surprised, but all the time I'm making notes. I mean, like this. This is a sheet of paper with sort of just notes of a book I'm writing at the moment. You can see, but I'm already. This is half the book on one sheet of paper. And I'm always doing that too. I take copious notes. I spend a lot of time structuring. I like to start a book sort of knowing about 60 to 70% of it. That leaves me 40% to 30, 40% to surprise myself and the reader.
Are there specific things in that 70%, specific plot points or characters that you feel like you need to know before you start the drafting process?
What I need, first of all, is a shape. Every novel to me has a shape. And it's sort of the shape of the novel comes to me. Like, for example, the one we're talking about with A Mind to Kill, you know, it was obvious to me that it was going to take place largely in Russia because that was the demands of the story. And then I realized it was going to be a three-part novel, that it was going to be London, Moscow, and then Berlin, East Berlin. And that then led me to sort of three separate interludes. And Fleming, of course, liked a three-part structure. My favorite is Goldfinger, Coincidence, Happenstance, American Enemy Action, which is just, you know, just great. It makes me smile. So I was happy with that shape of it. You know, my novel, Moriarty, if you've ever read it, I always saw it as a Mobius strip. I can't quite explain why that would be the case, but that was how it was, a novel that turned in on itself and did something impossible. So once I've got the shape, that's a start. Then I start to fill that shape with the sort of the action, if you like, the sort of, you know, where is going to be the murder or the chase or you know, the surprises and all that sort of stuff. And as to sort of the characters, they're there from the start. I mean, you know, I know Alex Rider very well. I grew up with Bond. Ditto Sherlock Holmes. Hawthorne, I'd written about him for many, many years before I started writing books about him. So these are characters who are very close to me, and I don't have to sit down and puzzle about them. I think that a character speaks to you. I think that's the only best way I can put it. I don't create the character. The character tells me about himself or herself. And if that sounds pretentious, because I don't like writers who say, oh, my characters are out of control, I never know what they're going to do. That's not true. I know everything my characters are going to do, but only because I know them so well.
Oh, yes. I can definitely relate to that. Mechanically, do you have a particular time or place when you write?
No, I write all the time, anywhere, everywhere, planes, trains, cafes, cemeteries, on the beach, park benches, on this table where I'm sitting now. I've been writing here for about 10 hours today. London, the countryside, abroad, anywhere. I never a day goes by, but I don't write.
Ah, lovely. Is there a particular program or tool or anything that you like to use to organize it all?
Not really. I try to avoid routine. I try not to. I don't do word counts. I don't start at 8 o'clock and do so many words by lunchtime. Again, going back to that idea of immersion. I'm a writer. You see, I think that some writers make the mistake, if I may say so. Every writer is different, and I don't know anything more than anybody else. In fact, my favorite saying is William Goldman's famous sentence: "Nobody knows anything." So you know, everybody to their own thing. But I think that for me, you can think of yourself: I'm an author, and here's my book. And how am I going to create that book? How am I going to plot it? How am I going to structure it? And to me, that doesn't work for me because I don't like to be outside the book. I don't think of the book as an object that's over there and I've got to somehow create it. I am the book. I'm in the book. The book is me. Christopher Isherwood wrote a wonderful sentence at the beginning of Goodbye to Berlin, which is, I am a camera. And I love that sense that what I do is that I take the first page of my novel and I don't think about the structure of the words. I think, what am I looking at? What am I seeing? Where am I? Where's the camera? You know, In the opening of With a Mind to Kill, I can't actually remember. In that the camera is high up above a cemetery, and it's closing in on these two characters who are arriving for the cemetery and who are going to have a conversation, and then you're going to cut to the hearse coming down from the hospital. So it's all visual. It's all very much, you know, as I say, I write TV and film, and so I have a very visual sort of mind.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because you've had a lot of experience in TV and film as well. Are there things that you do differently for your novels versus your television or screenplays?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, apart from anything else, there are things I can do in my novels I can't afford to do in television and film because, you know, it's all very much budget driven. But, you know, there are massive differences in writing a screenplay and writing a book. But I'm still more drawn to what makes them similar, and that is that sense of pace, excitement, immersion, of not letting you go, of surprise, of a ticking clock, of tricks, of magic, if you like. I love magic. There's a lot of magic in my books. Again, I mentioned Moriarty, which I think is one of my favorite books by myself because it's such a sort of a twisty, and the surprise at the end of the book is so shocking. And that was all inspired by a magic trick, a card trick. That I learned when I was a kid, and I adapted it for a book. So I forget what your question was now, but that I think is the answer.
Yes, yes. So a related question to the screenplay and the TV writing. Generally speaking, that's more of a collaborative effort, maybe a team of writers. Do you work alone in those instances, or do you have others you work with?
I'm not good at collaborating. I'm too single-minded. I'm too sort of confident. I'm too sure of myself. Perhaps these aren't good things to be, but I've been writing for a very long time. I know what I want, and I'm not good at sharing that with somebody else. But I have collaborated. The Alex Rider series, which is on television at the moment, on TV, on Amazon, was written by Guy Burt, and I collaborated with him to a certain extent on developing the scripts. They're all entirely his own work in terms of the writing, but nonetheless, we worked together. It was a lovely collaboration. He's a brilliant writer and brought things to the table that I didn't have, including a wonderful understanding of how teenagers think and talk to each other, relate and live. So the success of that show is much more down to him than to me. But I've just done another thing where I was working with another writer on a book. It was a disaster because it was just a conflict of wills, a conflict of you know, who shouts loudest. And I don't like that. You know, I'm not an unpleasant person, or at least I try not to be. I try to be nice. I think it's important. I think the world that we know at the moment is full of anger and violence and hostility. And I try to fight against that, to say that actually, we're all in this together. Let's be nice to each other, which I may sound a bit simplistic, but that is sort of how I live my life. So I don't want to fight with people over collaborations. In terms of TV, I'm married to my producer. Jill Green has produced a lot of my work, and it's a wonderful relationship. You know, we have a very, very happy marriage, which has lasted 33 years, and we have a very, very happy working relationship, which has lasted about 25. You know, we fight sometimes and we tussle over sort of ideas. She's always right, incidentally, but but that is a collaboration I enjoy very much.
Yes, she's probably always right. Yeah. I know that you've been vocal a bit about sort of a modern crisis in literature and the access to it for people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you mean, I'm not quite sure what you mean.
So I was reading some things that you wrote about the ability for people of all socioeconomic groups having access to literature.
Well, I think this is a wider issue, of course. I think that reading in this country, and possibly in yours too, is still a great socioeconomic divide. You know, if you look at areas in this country, I belong to a charity called the National Literacy Trust that has made a study in this, and there are areas of the country where life expectancy is shorter, where poverty is greater, where employment opportunities are smaller, and in those areas you often find that literacy is way, way lower. And there is a very strong link between people who read and their status in life. I think a great many people who read are of a certain ethnicity and of a certain class and even of a certain age. And I've always thought the right of reading and writing should be accessible to all, that that if you don't have books in your life, and I'm looking at you with all the books on the shelves behind you, and I think to myself that 1 in 10 houses in London have no books in them. That's a shocking statistic. But there are children growing up in 1 in 10 houses who don't own books. I mean, and I think to myself, how can you have a life which isn't informed by reading? And I think the way I look at the world and the way that social media has to a certain extent taken over our way of thinking, so that what you now have is a very binary way of looking at the world. Something is right or it's wrong, it's black or it's white, it's good or it's bad, and there's no in between. You try being ironic or being sarcastic or being humorous even on Twitter, you know, it will get you absolutely nowhere. Whereas fiction does the exact opposite. Fiction is many shades of gray. Fiction is about understanding that somebody who is foul and unpleasant and a monster was once a child and was once a good person and has either chosen to be bad or had it inflicted upon them. And if you don't understand that, if you don't empathize even with the worst people on this planet in some way, you will never understand them and you'll never beat them. And that is, of course, what fiction brings to us, which is why I have championed the idea that fiction should be accessible to all. And unfortunately, in the 21st century, we are finding more and more in this country with the closure of libraries, with less time given in schools to reading, with newspapers taking increasingly less interest in the books that are published every week, and many other sort of things, that writing and literature and fiction is somewhat taking a bit of a battering at the moment. I am an associate professor at a university in the southwest of London, where the entire English literature department has just been more or less shut down. And everybody's having to fight for their jobs against each other because literature and the humanities are considered to not be paying for themselves. But, you know, you grow up to be a namby-pamby author. How's that going to help you? Well, I'm an industry that brought a great deal of money and employment into this country, and I'm living proof that that is not the case, that success in writing is an enormous industry. So anyway, sorry, you'll forgive that little splurge. It was your fault for asking it, but I hope that sort of answers what you were getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. I often get caught in my own thoughts because I agree with you, and I wonder, is this cyclical, or are we heading down a path that we haven't been on before when it comes to the lack of reading resources?
I don't know is the answer to that. I suspect that it is just a continuation of a process that has been going on for a long time and will continue to go on for a long time. Because at the end of the day, you know, especially during COVID, book sales did rise. I think my concern is always that the people who read are belonging to one demographic. But for some reason, it doesn't break out. For example, I go to literary festivals in very leafy suburbs in attractive parts of the town. And I talk to more or less the same audience in every one of them. Now, I'm not describing that. These are wonderful occasions. I love going to them. I love meeting the people who want to come and talk about books. But it does bother me that they are in places like Oxford and Cambridge and Bath and Edinburgh and cities that are sort of refined and genteel. And that to me is troubling, only because I have gained so much pleasure from books and from literacy, but I want to share it with everyone.
Yeah. Well, you and I share one favorite book. I wanted to ask you about this. Bill Bryson's The History of Almost Everything. Definitely one of my favorite books. When did you come to that book, and what do you like about it?
Well, I had a sort of a spate of reading Bill Bryson. I mean, he wrote some wonderful travel books as well. And that one, that very dry humor, he's an all-round good guy. His campaigning against litter is something I very, very strongly support. The fact that he has chosen to live in my country and seems to like it here, despite all our manifest failings, is also admirable. But that book, which is a sort of a standalone, I think is in many ways his best book, is it's just sort of, it's such a wonderful introduction to so many different things. I mean, it is just a sort of a lighthearted, entertaining, jokey introduction to what it says, everything, but written with enormous intelligence and research and clarity. It's actually been some years since I read it, and it is sort of in my mind to read it again. Mm-hmm. I'm between houses at the moment, so all my books are in store. But when I pull it out and put it back on the shelf, it's something that I very much want to read a second time.
Yes. I found Bill through Walk in the Woods, and his style and voice just hooked me from the beginning. And I can remember when the history of almost everything came out. That was a no-brainer getting that book and reading it. So,
well, I have a very nice first edition of it, which if I ever get to meet him, I'll ask him to sign.
Ah, yes, that would be wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Anthony, I thought a great way for maybe us to wrap up the conversation would be for me to ask you what you are excited about. You've been in this business, in this industry for a long time. What's coming that's really exciting for you?
Well, first of all, everything excites me. I'm a person who's very easily excited. And I think that my love of writing, I still remember getting my first book in the post when I was 22 or something, and that excitement of actually holding a book for the first time. No, it's not here. I was going to actually pick one up and show it to you. Because I'm going to say the same thing is true today. My latest book arrived about an hour ago, and a great crate of books turn up here, and I can't stop turning it over my hands and feeling it and looking at it. So books still excite me. I think the Hawthorne series, which is the book of, a detective series, which I think run to about 11 or 12 volumes, before I finish, I have the next one in my head, and I'm quite excited to write that. And, I'll tell you something, actually. For me, the next book is what always excites me. The next Alex Rider. I've got a great idea for that now. The next Hawthorne. It's going to be something that no one has ever done before. Effectively, an argument between Hawthorne and myself as the book is being written. So the main character is arguing with the writer from beginning to end. I'm not sure that anyone has ever done that. They might have, but I haven't done it, so I'm excited by it. And, the next interview, the next, talking to you, I look forward to this. And instantly, it's been a really, really great conversation and a great chat. So thank you for being so enthusiastic and so well prepared and everything. But I'm getting older and my time is dwindling. And I'm fighting that by just being excited about it.
All right. This was a great interview. I love talking to these people with just decades of experience. It's like a masterclass. Start with you, JD. I know that you're a big fan of the James Bond universe. What'd you think?
Well, my first thought was I need to get a British accent, because you believe everything this guy says, regardless of what comes out of his mouth. He sounds like he just really knows what he's talking about. I love the original novels. I read all the Ian Fleming books when I was a kid, read them in order. And I guess in a lot of ways, it's sort of like reading Jack Reacher nowadays. There was no Jack Reacher back then, but he was kind of the grandfather, I guess, to Jack Reacher in a lot of ways. The books are very different from the movies. It's a complete, same characters, but other than that, it's a very different storyline. And I just devoured them. They were just, because they're just this crazy cross between the spy thriller and just a regular thriller and a mystery. And Ian Fleming is just so freaking good. So if you haven't read those, definitely check them out. I'm always harping about going back and reading some of the classics. And, that is the basis for a lot of the action movies. The Jack Reacher books, Jason Bourne, all of that kind of stuff is based on Ian Fleming and what he did with James Bond. The biggest takeaways for me, I think, is one of the things that he touched on is just writing in a different decade. It's a very tricky thing to do, and it's not as simple as a lot of people think. You can't just go on Google and figure out what people were wearing, what they were driving, what they were eating, and kind of go with that. He's taking it to another level. He's using the language that they used back then. Like if you read one of these books, it reads very much like an Ian Fleming book. He's using the same language that Fleming would have used. So I think that's important. I think it's trying to mimic the tone and everything. But at the same time, you know, you got to walk a tightrope. You know, these books were set, you know, Ian Fleming, you know, it's 50s, 60s. You know, there was racism. There was, you know, a lot of things going on that are very different today. You know, so as an author, do you stay true to that? Do you write, you know, as if you're in that decade? Do you try to sugarcoat it a little bit? You know, that's, you know, there's different camps on that for sure. I know for me personally, you know, if my character, if the story is taking place in 1950, I have them use language that they used in 1950. I don't change it up. A lot of other authors do change it, you know, so it's just, I guess it's a personal preference, but I think it feels more authentic if you actually write as if you're in that decade.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. Like, I would definitely lean on the side of authenticity. I mean, you have to, you know, when you're reading things like that, you have to understand it comes from that timetable, you know? So it's like, it's just the way things were back then, you know? So I think along what you're talking about too, I think it's really interesting. And admittedly, I've never read any of the Bond books. Like, I've seen several of the movies. And one thing I was thinking about as the interview was going was, like, if you have, I guess I can ask you, JD, because you've read a lot of these books, like, as far as, like, you have these people writing Bond in, like, different time periods and stuff now, what does that do to continuity? Like, if he's writing books about Bond in the 50s and 60s and then people are writing later, like, I don't know, like, does it, like, does that do anything with the continuity of the character or anything like that? Or, to, like, leave more to keep track of or what, like? I don't know. Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah. And it is different. You know, so you've got the original Ian Fleming books, the stuff that Anthony Horowitz is writing. They're almost like books that take place, you know, in between the Ian Fleming books. So it's almost like they discovered another Ian Fleming book that, you know, should have been between this one and this one. So okay. Like his books tend to kind of fall right in the middle of that world. The Jeffrey Deaver ones are a little bit different. That's, you know, it's more modern, different time frame. And, you know, and the movies are a complete, you know, different world. And it depends on which actor you're watching in those movies. I mean, the original ones with Sean Connery and Roger Moore are probably the closest that you're ever going to get to the original Ian Fleming books, because they were the first ones. They were based on those books. You know, but in today's world, you know, we've got this latest incarnation. They, you know, loosely based the Casino Royale on the book, but they modernized it. You know, it took place in today's world. So they had to make a lot of tweaks based on that. I like the nostalgia of going back and reading that old stuff. And, you know, like, you don't necessarily, I mean, there's gadgets and all that, but, you know, that was something that really came out of the movies, not so much from the original books. And they didn't need it. I mean, it was all about the story. And, you know, I think that's why they've stood the test of time. That's why they've been remade over and over again.
So I wanted to ask you guys about something that I didn't push into in the interview, because that was pretty clear. I didn't need to, but it got me thinking about something. And I was like, this would be something good we could talk about after the interview. So Anthony said, you know, basically he doesn't take like writer's courses. He didn't go to school for writing. He can't articulate his own process. He just immerses himself in it. And it kind of made me think we're back to a question we've tried tackling before, which is, are good writers born or made? Because if this guy just kind of, you know, he didn't have any sort of formal training as a storyteller, and yet he's this prolific and successful. Like, what does that mean as far as talent versus skill versus, you know, I don't know. I just kind of an open-ended comment/question.
I think the real takeaway is you don't have to step into a classroom to learn something. You know, he's a very accomplished author, but it's really mainly because he's a very accomplished reader. You know, he's got a history of reading behind him. You know, he's obviously was extremely passionate about books and where they are. And, you know, he mentioned, you know, one out of every 10 households don't own books and things like that. Like, you know, that's where his head's at. But, you know, I think by reading, you know, as much as, you know, he does, you know, like he's absorbed that structure, you know, the storytelling process, the framework, the three-act structure, however you want to, you know, so he may not think of his books, you know, as a three-act structure, but I bet you if you were to sit down and map them out, that's probably there. You know, he understands that, you know, just because he's read so many stories, you know, the pacing needs to pick up at this point. You know, this needs to happen at this point. The twist needs to happen here. My climax needs to happen here. You know, he had mentioned his cadence cadence and sentence structure, how he tends to go, you know, use fewer words and shorter sentences when he's trying to, you know, bring a point across that's moving faster to break, you know, bring his pacing up. These are all things that he just picked up from, you know, reading people that really knew what they were doing. So I think, you know, and if you go through authors that have been doing this for a very long time, the most successful ones are like that. You know, very few of them have had any real formal training. I think it's a misnomer to think that you can go to college, get an MFA and churn out a book and all of a sudden you're an author and you know what you're doing. If you're not a heavy, hardcore reader before you do all that, I don't think they can teach this to you in school. There is something that we talk about called the storyteller gene. I think that's legit. I think there's certain people that are born capable of telling a story. And as long as you've got that, you can be an author, because you can learn grammar, you can learn punctuation, but you can't learn how to tell a story.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I've always stood in the camp of, I think the best way to become a writer is to read and to write, is just to practice it, and keep getting better. And also, I'll add to that, you know, I learn a lot out of just having conversations with other writers who are doing this day and day, like me. For example, before the interview, when we were talking about dialogue tags and stuff, I mean, those types of conversations lead to me becoming a better writer, like having those sorts of conversations and opening my mind to, oh, like I should try doing this, or I should look at this in my own sort of writing. Cause I'm right with JD. Like, I don't think that necessarily going to school and getting an MFA is gonna, you know, I was having the same conversation with somebody the other day about going to business school. I'm like, you're going to business school, like you're not gonna learn it until you're actually, you know, in trying to run a business and you're on the ground doing it, you know, because you're learning at a school from somebody who's not running a business. and a lot, like, not to go too deep in that, but anyways, like that, I'm the same way. Like, to me, personally, when I go out to actually like learn something about my business, you know, to read about or whatever, like to me as a modern author in these days, I'll spend that time doing stuff that's more marketing related than writing. Cause again, I feel like, instead of like reading books on craft, I just need to read books and just keep writing and try to get a little bit better every single day.
Well, I think a lot of that just stems from the process, right? You probably spent your whole life reading, so you learned how to tell a story because of that. But you didn't spend your whole life doing marketing. You know, it's a byproduct of what you've become. You've become a writer because of, you know, your history and your passion for books. But, you know, you have to market in this world. Yeah. So that's something you have to learn. So like, to me, like if I had to go to school, gun to my head, like I would go for marketing, you know, right now, today. I know how to tell a story, but you can always learn. You know, I can always learn more when it comes to marketing.
Yeah. I also, Jay brought this up. I also love his bringing awareness to reading and stuff and having access to books. I think that is, you know, like I can go, you know, there's a library right around the corner for me. There's another one down the street, but you have to remember, like, not everybody has that easy of access to books. And even beyond that, you know, we're moving into this world where, and I think you kind of talked about this, like Jay, when you asked him if it was cyclical or you were moving towards this, but all this technology that's kind of moving us away from sitting down and reading a book. I mean, Jay, you've even said, and I tend to agree with you, you know, you don't count audiobooks as reading because you're able to do other things. You know, you can like listen to an audiobook and do chores or walk on the treadmill, but when you're reading, it actually requires the discipline of sitting down and focusing and reading. So I don't know, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, again, I'm not judging people who listen to audiobooks.
Yeah, and I know you weren't. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I don't. I think any way you're consuming books is a good thing. But I was listening to the Huberman Lab podcast. It's amazing. Very sciencey. But he had a guy on, and his specialty was like speech and sound. And I had no idea this was the case. He said, when we read, we are speaking the words as we're reading, but it's at such a low level that you don't even know you're doing it, and you can't hear other people doing it. But you're literally speaking the words as you read them, and that doesn't happen with an audiobook. So I do think there is something to be said for reading with the eyeballs.
Yeah, and I will say too, like I'm not. you know, I love audiobooks, like specifically like nonfiction, even though I've started to read more nonfiction than I was before. But also I also am like a really good Audible learner. So no pun intended. Like I, you know, a lot of times like when I hear things, I retain them better. So, but like you said, there's also the science to that. But either way, I feel like we're kind of going off on a tangent, which is my fault. But I do love him bringing the attention to like just having access to books and stuff, because I think that that's especially as we're moving into this world that is becoming more, you know, younger people listen to me. I sound old like you two, moving more towards like, you know, platforms like TikTok that are very visual based and stuff. And now, you know, we're talking about virtual reality and all this stuff. Like, I think that just, you know, not getting away from sitting down and reading, and for the reasons you talked about too, like the science around it, is super important.
Well, it's strange if you think about it, because I can see 100 years from now there being no physical libraries anymore. I can see like the print book disappearing, you know, from that medium.
Yeah, 100%.
But at the same time, you know, like access to books has never been greater than it is now. You know, you can read them on your computer, you can read them on your phone, you can get them from anywhere. But yeah, reading is still declining, even in that saturated environment. So I find that to be interesting. It's hopefully it's something that's changing. I mean, I just got an email from my daughter's teacher, and she was explaining they're buying some books from Schoolastic, and she sent the list over of books that they're going to get, and like reading and writing is a huge part of their kindergarten, their training program. They've got daily journals that they keep and things like that. You know, to me, like that is extremely encouraging, and I don't know if that's something that's been going on, you know, for decades, and every kindergarten group does it, but to know that my daughter is going through that, I find that encouraging.
Yeah, I've said for a long time that, you know, I got really turned off by reading in school because of required reading. And I really wish that schools would just focus more on like getting kids to read, even if it's not like a classic literary novel, than to like try to force them to read stuff that like might turn them off from reading, you know? So that's what I'm trying to do with my daughter is, you know, we've been reading Goosebumps and like Minecraft books and stuff, like things that she's interested in. But I just want her to be excited to like sit down at the end of the night or whatever and like crack open a book and consume story. So no matter what it is.
That's actually a really good point. You know, like they kind of force feed these particular titles on, you know, kids and, you know, every grade. I mean, all the way up through high school, there's certain books that you have to read. But yeah, I wonder what would happen if they actually just let kids read what they're actually interested in instead of forcing them to read something else. That might change the entire dynamic. Maybe that's the problem. Who knows?
Yeah, I know for me, like I said, when they were like, you need to read these five books during the summer or whatever, like it, I was like, totally turned. But if they would have said, hey, pick five books you want to read, that would have been different, you know, because I probably would have done it and I would have been reading, you know. So but anyways, yeah. So I'd like to see that. So.
All right. Zach for president.
There you go. Vote early, vote often. Yeah, I want to just say, yeah, Anthony was a great interview. So we were so fortunate to have him on the show. The only thing is I'm a little bit envious that I don't have a skull. So, you know. Maybe I can pick one up, or I can have my mom buy me one for my birthday. We'll see.
I'll put mine in your will. In my will.
Okay. All right. Yeah. If you can give me yours, that would be really cool. Like your skull, right? Like you're gonna die first and give me your skull. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
I'll make sure they keep a beard on it and everything.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you're allowed to mail that sort of thing.
Well, he can just pick it up after my viewing.
Okay.
They can just get rid of it.
I'll just take it home with me in a doggy bag. All right, we're off the rails.
Yeah, we're totally off the rails.
Next week, we've got Martin Edwards coming on. He's going to be here to discuss. It's actually a pretty unique project. It's called The Life of Crime. It's a deep dive into the history of mysteries and crime fiction over the past 50 years. So that should be a lot of fun.
Awesome. Looking forward to it. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.